you were saying?
So when it came time for me to go to school, I had $7 in my pocket, which wasn't enough to buy the bus fare. So I got on the street and Tom White went away to Lewisburg Junior College. I finished the junior college and then I transferred over to Atlantic Christian College. Lewisburg is in Lewisburg, North Carolina. Atlantic Christian is in Wilson, North Carolina. While I was at Atlantic Christian, I, in addition to teaching music and conducting the band, I taught three little high school bands in nearby cities. Plus, in the summertime, I went to the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, music school there. So, I was graduated. I'd been playing in the National Guard band. And just as luck would have it, my National Guard unit was the first one in the entire United States that was called up. In September of 1940, I graduated in June. I was called up in 1940 for federal service. So I came in the service as an enlisted man, most unhappy, didn't want to be a soldier. I had had an appointment to the military academy when I was a sophomore in college, turned it down because I did not want to be a military person. So I came in ostensibly for 1 year, but that didn't work. And pretty obvious that we were going to be in much longer than 1 year. So I attended a school and was commissioned in March of 41 and stayed in the military continuously until 74. So I had, actually 75, I guess. So I had a total of, and my National Guard service, 40 years and 21 days I was in the military.
How did you thought?
And then as far as the academic, after coming into the military, I was fortunate in that I did attend each, in fact, every one of the latter of the military schools, to include the two basic infantry schools, then into the Command General Staff College, the Armed Forces Staff College, and the National War College. So I did have the privilege of an entire military educational ladder. I went to the Graduate School of Business at Harvard, finished that. And I have a master's also in political science from George Washington University. So my academic as well as my military training continued during my service. I guess it's all inherited from my parents, the thought that academic training is not too bad. So I enjoy it.
What did you do during World War II?
As far as military service is concerned, I'm told that I've had more actual troop command than any general officer that we have. I've had 21 years of troop command service. So I came in as an infantryman. I stayed in an infantry frontline outfit throughout World War II. I then went down to the infantry school at Fort Benning, Georgia, and taught infantry tactics for 3 years, then to Leavenworth for the Command General Staff College, then to Korea, where I actually we went to Tokyo. The war was just starting as I was finishing Leavenworth. I was on the staff to plan the Incheon landing in Korea. I made the Incheon landing in the forward elements with the Marine Division. I stayed over there, what they call a double tour. I stayed there 2 years as G3 of the 10th Corps. Came back for a two-year tour on the Army staff. Went to the Armed Forces Staff College at Norfolk. Came back to the Pentagon, was on the staff of the Secretary of Defense. I went from there to command an infantry regiment at Fort Carson, Colorado, and took it to Europe, commanded it in Europe for 3 years. Was on the Army staff over there for a year. Came back to the National War College. Took parachute training. Came up to the Army staff for full tour. And went from the Army staff to Okinawa, where I organized a very special unit. The Army decided that this was in 63. The Army decided that we're going to do everything we can to advance the state of the art, and we're going to organize experimental units and try every new thought that comes up. So they organized two major units with two different approaches. Organized one at Fort Benning, Georgia, that was called the Air Assault Division. In other words, learning to use helicopters and things like that. And their approach was to have people, the Army staff and the school systems and what have you, write out procedures and things that they thought would work. Write them out in just as great a detail as they could, send them to Benning and have Benning try them, see if they were practical. I was put over on the island of Okinawa, which was intentionally out of the limelight, organized what they call the Pacific Fire Brigade. It was the only airborne separate brigade that we had in the Army. My mission was to try new ideas based on just ideas rather than the printed page, the mimeograph sheet, and what have you. I was given absolute top priority as far as personnel was concerned. I got the pick of the West Point graduating class. I got the pick of the non-commissioned officer schools and things of that sort. I got the very best people that could be had. And I was given a balanced command of infantry and artillery and engineers and signal and tanks and helicopters and what have you, and told to just try ideas. Anything that worked well, perfect it as best you can, write it up in skeleton form if necessary, but write it up enough that it can be understood back at the headquarters and send it back. So I was an experimental unit over there. We experimented by parachute dropping people, supplies. We even parachuted our tanks. We just tried it all. We sent patrols out on submarines. We operated from aircraft carriers. We made parachute jumps in 8 different foreign countries in the next 2 years. I think we made some 85,000 parachute jumps all over the Far East, just trying new ideas. Incidentally, I'm very, very proud of the fact that we made all those parachute jumps without permanently injuring a single individual. Nobody killed and nobody permanently. A lot of us hurt, a lot of us bombed up a little bit, but nobody permanently injured. Mm-hmm. Oh, and incidentally, I became an airplane pilot too, both fixed wing and helicopter. And then when the thing build up started in Vietnam, we were the Pacific Reserve, so we were naturally the first ones to go down. So the Marines went in the north and we went in the south, and we were charged with holding the door open until the units from the States could get there. And I stayed over 2 years with that. Came back to the Pentagon for a 2-year assignment, then went to Iran, 2-year assignment, and then got seriously ill, hospitalized for 6 months, and had to retire, much to my chagrin. Mm. I was not ready to retire.
Can I ask you some questions about some of the material you talked about, actually?
Okay.
About, you mentioned, during World War II, did you serve in Europe? Or,
yes. Yeah. We went over. I was in England for 6 months and preparing for the Channel Crossing, and I made the Channel Crossing and landed in there and went all the way across to the end of the war.
D-Day?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, you say D-Day, I'm sorry, no, D plus six. We were in what they call the floating reserve. And, you know, the Germans didn't want us to come in, so they were kind of mean about it. And there where we were just floating around, there was a counterattack between two of our forward divisions, the 1st and the 29th, and we were jammed in between those two and stayed in and went on to the end of the war. And we were actually being deployed. By then I was commanding a regiment, and we were being deployed, supposedly going to the Far East. So we came back through, stopped in England for just a few weeks, 3 weeks I guess, then came on, landed in New York, and were given a month's leave. The atomic bomb was dropped while we were in England. We were given 30 days leave. We were to assemble at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. Before the 30 days was out, they sent a message out extending it to 45 days. And then when I went to Fort Jackson expecting to assemble my command, I didn't get much. I released, I think it was 5,100 people at the New York port, and word went out the army was being, we call it demolished instead of demobilized, and people were sent messages, so if you don't want to stay in the service, so go to your nearest processing station and be separated. So of the 5,100, I got 600 back. I didn't have many people for a regiment, so we were all reassigned something else.
Well, at what point did you decide you wanted a military career? Because you said you were dubious about it before.
That was over a long period of time, you might say, but I think probably early in my commission service, as I mentioned, I was an enlisted man on about 6 months of active duty from September until March. And then as a junior officer, I just liked people and the Army more than any of the other services except the Marines are people oriented. And working with people just sort of impressed me. So actually, before we were sent overseas in 1944, I applied for a regular commission. My application was approved all the way up to the top, and I'd been told it was approved, and I was just waiting to have my swearing in. But then I was informed just before we left that the Department of the Army had discontinued regular commissions until after the war, and that my application would be held in abeyance. And it was. And I was commissioned after I came back home in the regular Army.
You mentioned you were involved in the Korean War. You helped plan the Incheon landing, you
think? Yes.
How far into North Korea did you actually go? Were you involved in the landing?
You mean physically?
Yeah.
All the way.
Yeah.
All the way to
Yellow.
Yeah.
Then you
see, we made the Incheon landing, which literally cut off the forces down, the enemy forces down there. And General MacArthur explained very plainly, he said it's going to be just like you have an electric fan sitting here on the desk, and you walk over to the wall and pull the cord. He says, if as our Incheon landing is successful, they will have to withdraw, which was absolutely true. They did. And it just destroyed their force. And then we swung around, came out of, actually deployed back from Incheon and from Busan, came around, landed at Wonsan, went up the east coast and on across, and got involved all the way up to the biggest battles were around the Chosin Reservoir. And we had forces went all the way to the Yalu River. We were spread I was responsible, my left arm alone was 400 miles. It was spread all over everywhere. And Then we came back after the Chinese came in, we came around, came back through Busan, back up and into the war. So I actually stayed 2 years. I stayed until the front was completely stabilized. And then I came back on the Army staff. I handled all the communications for the Panmunjom negotiations. So I lived Korea for 3 years, 4 years, almost.
So about 53 or so? Or either?
I came back in 52, and I had this job of a communications analyst for almost 2 years.
Huh. Now, you mentioned earlier that you were involved, that you worked in the Defense Department in the mid-50s. I guess you were in the ISA division?
Yes, area. I was in ISA, and when I finished the Armed Forces Staff College, and that was 53, 4, 5, and 6. When it must have been 4, 5, and 6. I left the ISA in 56.
What were your duties at International Security Affairs? Generally,
I was in what they call MDAP, Military Defense Assistance Program. We handled the military assistance for 147 different countries, and we thought we were managing the programs. And we were responsible for making the congressional presentations. I went over to Congress every year and participated in those exercises, usually as a horse holder. I didn't do a lot of talking, some, but we were involved in the military assistance program. And incidentally, during that period of time, the country of Iran was singled out as one of the few countries that could accept military, one of the few underdeveloped countries that could accept military assistance and in time be on its own.
That was a planning assumption at that point.
That was a planning assumption, and from the standpoint of the program was implemented in that, and this is something a lot of people don't quite understand, is we did in fact give as a donation, a grant, grant aid it was called, a good bit of World War II surplus equipment. That was a gift. And then we started the FMS, the Foreign Military Sales Program. Initially we had the Iranians pay for the spare parts for the items that we had given them. And as time went on, the Iranians paid for everything to include the item itself, the spare parts, the technical manuals, the training, plus a portion of the research and development expense of our making the item initially.
It was under FMS.
Under FMS. Uh-huh. Now, all of that was a developmental thing, but to give you an idea, by the time I got over there in 1971, the Iranians, I got over there before their big bash, their, what I call their debutante ball. It was their coming out party. And they had representatives, top level, the top man in most instances, 69 different countries over there to celebrate their debutante ball. As they put it, they would join the community of advanced nations. And they wanted everybody to see what they had done. But from then on, the Shah says there are several things, and when I say the Shah, he spoke for the country. He personified the country. So often you'll hear me use the expression the Shah when I mean the country or something. But anyway, he said there are several things that will prevail at all times. We will pay our way. We will not accept anything free. And as we pay our way, we will have every contract very, very carefully examined. And this became one of my biggest jobs. Every contract was examined to be sure that there was no improper commission, influence, peddling, things of that sort. Now, a lot of the Americans, particularly the American businessmen, didn't believe he was serious on that. And they learned the hard way. But he was. As an example, someone showed him a copy of the Congressional Record one time, our Congressional Record, that showed a line item in there of just $25,000. Now, we were dealing then in terms of hundreds of millions of dollars. During my tenure alone, I signed contracts, for I believe it finally came out at about $5.4 billion. So we were dealing in big money. And someone showed the Shah a little line item of $25,000 military assistance for Iran. And the Shah says, let's find out what this is all about. And if I owe it, I'll give you a check tomorrow. Well, as it turned out, somebody was figuring back here in the job that I'd had years before, getting ready for a presentation to the Congress. And he had a general administrative expense for that part of the world. And he just arbitrarily divided up the expenses among the several countries and listed them. Inadvertently listed Iran. The Shah would not accept anything free at all during the time I was there.
Well, back in the 50s, though, military aid was in the form of
grants, right? 50s, I would say it was predominantly, almost exclusively, grant.
Did you yourself work on military aid for Iran? Did you do any planning in that regard?
I thought several times, and except for the country of Iran being one of the two or three countries that could. See, we looked at countries and we said, yes, we're helping England, for instance. There were several things that we had done a lot of research and development on, and England was very interested in it. We would give them maybe a prototype model or a few manuals, insignificant things. We gave things to England and to Germany. You know, Germany was building a 12th Division Army at that time, so Germany was one of our biggest customers. France and just lots of countries, but countries of that sort that had been industrialized, there was no question about it. They get grant aid and we give them something and write it off. That's it. Iran and a good many other countries, such as Greece, for instance, we realized that if we gave them something, they couldn't afford to maintain it yet, and some of them, we didn't see in the immediate future that they would be able to maintain it. So,
including Iran.
That's what I'm saying. Iran eventually, during the time that I was there, and I was not the top man and I was just a worker, but during the time that I was there, Iran, it was identified as one of the countries that we foresaw their being able to pay their way. Complete, 100%. A lot of the other countries, we got in real trouble by trying to make them just pay for their spare parts.
Mm-hmm. If it's possible to generalize, what were some of the goals of the military assistance program for Iran in the mid-50s, or when you were working there? What were seen as the major purposes for providing military assistance?
I wrote my master's degree thesis on military assistance in underdeveloped countries. And in that, my principal finding was, it's impossible. It can't be done. You can't leave the country in an underdeveloped situation and give it very much military assistance. you will destroy the country, you will inundate it with something that they can't take care of. So, to have a country that you think is friendly to our country, is geographically located, that it's essential to our country, to have that country with a military capability requires that you develop the country too. So, our military assistance program was geared to assist Iran in becoming a modern country. Now, what was the armed force at that time? Armed forces. They had their navy physically shot out of the water. The British did a yeoman job of steaming into the Persian Gulf and raising holy hell. There was no Iranian navy to speak of at all. Their army was a ragtag, underdeveloped mob. They never had been fantastic. They never had been much. And then as World War II tore them asunder, they became less. So at that time, the army had a massive bunch of folks, but 50-year-old rifles and things of that sort. The Air Force was non-existent. They had a few little liaison type city airplanes, but there was no Air Force. So the approach for the three services was entirely different from each other. Three different approaches. There was no one approach to the armed forces of Iran. The Air Force was going to be, quote, made. We were going to develop an Air Force. It was to be a carbon copy of the U.S. Air Force, scaled down pretty quickly, and not the most sophisticated airplanes, but airplanes that would fly in a combat environment. Every pilot of the Iranian Air Force was physically trained in the United States. Every form that they had was a facsimile copy, even to the extent of including printed in the United States. So, and all of the Air Force was required to speak English. Everything in the Air Force was new. So they took high school and college graduates, taught them English, made them learn the U.S. Air Force. So it was carbon copy. The Navy was starting from scratch, almost non-existent. And they started with a few, I think they had U.S., British, Italian, and French. Coastal type vessels, and they acquired ships on a one at a time basis, so their navy grew very slowly, but it was extremely small. Their army was the problem. In fact, their army was so much bigger than all the others. In Iran, the word army means all of them. If you speak of just what we call the army, you have to say ground forces. So the army was the three combined, and they had the Air Force, the Navy, and the ground forces. Their ground forces were, as I said, just a mob of people. So the first thing to do was to just get rifles, mortars, and machine guns that were acceptable. But we just didn't have near enough of them to give them. And as long as you've got to develop a nation, the idea was to make their own. So about that time we started developing factories in Iran to make small arms.
This is back in the 50s?
This was in the late 50s, yeah. 60s, mid-60s, long in there. This was over a period of time. I'd say in the 50s, probably there were no factories. I was not there. But probably there were no factories in the 50s. But when the, what they call the white revolution got underway, they were building little plants to fabricate a lot of things. And as you can well imagine, initially, a lot of it was just assembly. They were just assembling things, all the parts that were made somewhere else. But the Germans did a lot in there, the Romanians did some, the Italians did a whale a lot, the British did some, we did some. And we gave them a good bit of World War II surplus tanks, because we had a good many, and of course it was too much to expect them to make their own tanks and artillery, so we gave them tanks and artillery. And as the 60s developed in the early 70s, they started purchasing. And by then, the Vietnam War had started. And although they wanted to buy 100% U.S., we couldn't let them have our production. So we were in a position where we just producing for ourselves, couldn't supply them. So we licensed Italy to build helicopters. The Iranians bought tanks from England. They bought a few missiles, some anti-aircraft guns from Germany. They bought artillery, armored personnel carriers, and engineer equipment from Russia. And they were paying for all this stuff. This was not grand at all. They preferred U.S. equipment. They wanted U.S. equipment across the board. But we couldn't do it. They were constantly, by the time I got over, they're just begging us to sell them stuff. And we were quite hesitant for two reasons. One, we just didn't have the production capability, but mainly, we thought maybe they were pushing their military too fast. By the time I got over there, my very definite instructions were, you are not a salesman. You are not encouraged. You are not to encourage the Iranians to buy any additional systems. For the entire time I was over there, I never even once suggested that they buy one single thing, except sometime they're going to our computers, their supply spare parts on a certain item was getting level, and I told them to look at that very carefully. They might need some more spare parts, and they took my advice on that. There was one other time that I told them that they didn't have the capability of recovering the tanks of the weight that they were buying from England. That those Centurion tanks were too heavy for their lightweight tank recovery things. And I said, you need to look around and find a tank recovery vehicle that will pull. I said, you can recover a tank that loses the track on the road. But if a tank, the weight of that Centurion runs off the road and gets in a ditch, you don't have the capability to pull it out of the ditch and recover it.
A practical question.
And they took my advice on that. But of the whole time I was over there, those were the only two items I ever told them, suggested that they buy. I was on the negative side quite frequently in telling them that I thought they either had enough, thought they should not buy this particular item because it was, in fact, too complicated. They fact, the only time that the Shah really got upset with me or showed any signs of being upset with me is one time I told him he was pushing so fast that I didn't think his available personnel would support his program on the time schedule that he had.
How did he respond to that?
And he says, "Now, what do you mean by that?" And I said, "What you need is trainable people." And by what he, what one, well, it went in two different sections. One time when I told him I didn't think he had enough, I laughed until my very horror discovered that he had ordered the entire graduating class of a university to be inducted into the Navy. Just like that. He didn't ask anything about who's graduating, what about them, what are their plans, and he ordered the entire class to go to the Navy. And he told people who did that because General Williamson told him he didn't have enough people to support his program. So I went in to see him and I said, "We've overreacted and let's talk about this a little bit." And I said, "Look, you do need a lot of technicians." And at that time we were talking principally about his Army aviation program, almost exclusively helicopters. And I said, "You do need to train a lot of pilots, but you need to train many, many more mechanics, communication specialists, maintenance specialists." I said, "You need to train a lot of people. And in my judgment, you can't train them fast enough to support this program." And I says, "This decree about the university graduate taking the graduating class, I said, in my judgment, you are hurting your community. You are hurting the civilian economic sector at the expense of your military, and it's not necessary, it's not appropriate." I said, "You need a lot of intelligent people, trainable people, but they don't have to be college graduates." I said, "You can train a lot of your radio technicians with high school educations, and they will not only be just as good, in time they may very well be happier. A college graduate that has a good job, good maintenance job, may not think it's a very good job, but a high school graduate may think that's a real good job." So he, the next day I was invited to a meeting with the Prime Minister, Mr. Hobeko, called the Chief of the Imperial Staff, Chief of the Air Force, Chief of the Navy, Chief of the Army, Chief of the Gendarmerie, Chief of Education, Chief of Finance. Had the very top level. And he stood up there and he says, "General Williamson has thrown out a challenge, and His Imperial Majesty has ordered us to prove him wrong." So he took, and I don't know what got me off on this tangent, but he took it personally in that I thought he didn't have enough people. So then they started the deal. See, their draft system took people in for 2 years, but the same person that may elect not to be drafted but to join the regular Army could come in, and if he had the educational background, he could join as a regular. Instead of being used as a conscript, he would be sent to what they call the NCO Academy. He would be made a non-commissioned officer, and he had signed up for life. There was no 30 years or something. He signed up for life. He signed up for just as long as the armed forces wanted his services. And I believed in it too. But during this meeting that the Prime Minister had, they started talking about maybe we need to think in terms of a shorter enlistment if we're going to have all these people in there. And they use that expression several times. I finally spoke up and I said, now, what are you visualizing? I have your 2-year bracket here and I have your lifetime bracket. What are you talking about now with a short enlistment? They said 11 years. It shows you the difference in their thinking and ours. But they instituted the deal where a man could sign up for 11 years and come in and be given a pretty good education. So their approach was different.
Interesting. Oh, I have a question. Back to the ISA period. Did they have a sort of a RAND desk there? People that specialize in uranium matters?
ISA was not nearly so big then as it is now. We had a very small group. I guess we had 10, maybe 12 officers worldwide. Mm-hmm. And we were running around from pillar to post, jumping through the hoop, trying to keep ourselves reasonably educated.
Did you do much traveling?
Almost none. We didn't have time to travel.
Yeah.
Didn't have money either at that time. Money was very restricted. But during the entire time I was there, I didn't make one single trip. And of the 10, 12 people we had in our office, I'd say not over 3 or 4 of them got out of the building. Mm-hmm. We didn't travel at all.
Who was the superior officer?
The ISA secretary was Mr. Gordon Gray and Mr. H. Drew Hensel, quite a period of the time. General Fox was in charge of the, Alonzo Fox was in charge of the military assistance program as such. And then General Maroon lives out in California.
General Maroon?
M-A-R-O-U-N. Audrey Joseph Maroon was there. I think he, General Fox and General Maroon were the senior people. They were one-star generals. We weren't a big section at all. We were supposedly international security affairs, but the Department of Defense wasn't very active in the overall policy of that at the time. By very active, I mean we were not in the nitpicking, bookkeeping part of it at all. We were supposedly policy, but I was a lieutenant colonel, promoted to colonel while I was in there. And we were hassling in an effort to just understand what we were doing.
That's how it takes us.